Support for Father David Abernethy and his ministry at the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri comes entirely from the donations of community members and listeners like you. The creation of future groups and podcast episodes depends on your commitment and generosity. We humbly ask that you consider a monthly gift of $10 to the Pittsburgh Oratory in support of Father David and his work. To make this or any gift, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org, click the Donate button, and write Father David in the notes section. You can also make a recurring or one-time donation directly through Podbean. Your commitment and ministry-sustaining support are greatly appreciated. God bless you, and enjoy the podcast.
Was in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back everybody to our study of the Evergetinos, and we're picking up tonight with hypothesis 13, which we started last time, and we're on page 107 of the text with number 7 at the bottom of the page. And if you remember, we've been speaking about the Father's counsel to seek out a remote place, which certainly would speak to the monk seeking to live the life of solitude and of deep prayer and stillness, and to foster that. But we also began to see very quickly that this is not all that they had in mind, that the kind of remoteness and the stillness, even the exile that they embraced, was something that produced a great spiritual fruit, humility, control of the tongue, as well as silence. And kind of poverty of spirit. And so we began to look also certainly at what this means for us living in the world. How do we experience this kind of remoteness, or even the experience of kind of exile within our world today? And certainly I think we can look again at our lives and see many ways where there's a kind of almost natural exile that would come to us in the sense of not being able to participate and many of the things of the world. If we were seeking to foster virtue within our hearts and to avoid the vices, that we're going to seek to simplify our lives, but also to avoid the things that would stimulate the passions, and to live the gospel fully is also going to bring upon us a kind of scorn from the world. And at least this is what Christ tells us we are to expect. And so our life in this world, in a sense, is an exile. Today, I came across a little quote from St. Philip Neri, for the true Christian has no other country than heaven. And so we are living in a kind of exile until we know the fullness of that life of the kingdom. And we should live our lives in all respects in that way, that we live with our eyes focused upon our God and the promise of life that has been given to us and made possible for us through the Paschal mystery. And insofar as we take our eyes off of that and become focused upon the things of the world or overly attached to the things of this world, we've moved away certainly from the gospel, but also the counsel of the fathers here in regards to embracing this kind of self-imposed exile, if you will. And so not all of us are called to move to the desert, but all of us are called to the exile that is attached to living the gospel within a fallen world. And the world will hate us as it hated Christ if we're living the gospel fully, and we are to be prepared for that. We're picking up with another story this evening, and it's sort of interesting. It's two neighbors who are alike in almost every way, and we've come across this before, but the end experience of each one is quite different for a subtle reason, and which we'll come to. So again, we're on number 7. One of the fathers relates the following. There were once two neighbors. One was a foreigner and the other a native to the place where they lived. The foreigner was a little lazy, while the native, on the other hand, was quite industrious. It happened, however, that the foreigner died first. Their elder, since he had the gift of clairvoyance, saw a great group of angels guiding his soul up to heaven. But the moment it reached up to heaven and was ready to enter, there took place an examination as to the worthiness of the soul to enter. Then a voice from on high was heard to say, "It is clear that he was indeed a bit lazy, but open up to him, since he removed himself from the world." So mark that little point there, because it's an unusual thing that even despite his laziness, the fact that he had left country, left what was familiar, what was secure, is seeing something acting in his favor. Shortly thereafter, the native reposed, and all of his relatives came for his funeral. The clairvoyant elder noticed that there were no angels anywhere, and he was amazed. So he fell down before God with tears and said, "How is it that the foreigner, even though he was lazy, enjoyed such glory, while this monk, though industrious, experienced no such thing?" Immediately a voice from heaven told him the following. This industrious monk here, when the moment of his death was approaching, opened his eyes and saw his relatives crying. This comforted his soul. However, though he was lazy, the foreigner nonetheless saw none of his own at the time of his death. His loneliness caused him to cry and groan. Thus God comfort him. So it's an interesting thing. When we come to study St. John Climacus and his writings, he has one of the early steps is on exile. And so we'll be able to look at this in depth in his writing. But this idea of clinging to God alone and being attached to nothing within this world, that the native had a kind of comfort and the security of being in a familiar place, knowing that if needed, he would have someone who would care for him or be able to provide for him, that he would have the support of family. And indeed, at the time of his death, he has the support of his family. They all come to him and comfort his soul. And so, unlike Christ, who had no place to lay his head, this monk, had at least the comfort and the security of being around a familiar place and knowing that there would be those who would tend to him in any kind of need. So even though he lived an industrious life, from all externals, he was living a disciplined religious spiritual life. There was part of him that was attached to that security, that did not rest upon God alone. And this is not something that one would be easy to perceive in an individual. I think from all externals, very much like the Pharisees in the Gospels, one can be doing all the right things or saying all the right things and have the external appearances of being religious and religiously minded. But it doesn't necessarily speak to what is in the depths of one's heart. And so the appearance of laziness on the surface alone does not reveal to us the state of this one monk's heart, that despite his temperament and tendency towards laziness in some forms, there was nonetheless the desire to give himself over completely to God. And that in the sense of not allowing himself the comforts of this world. So while not being perfectly disciplined, his heart belonged alone to God and was attached alone to God. And this might seem to be a rather subtle and sort of obscure story. And some of us might even balk at it a little bit and say, hey, but it's a little bit like the Martha and Mary story within the gospel. Everybody becomes the defender of Martha because everybody has a sister like Mary who seems to sit around and do nothing. and Martha, the industrious one, you know, on the surface appeals to us in that regard, you know, that if we're doing the right things and if we're being industrious, and even in the case of Martha, of being hospitable, you know, of providing for the needs of her Lord, that there was in some way she was not seeing the greater truth, that she had the beloved in her presence, the one who was going to nourish her upon his word. And Mary understood this, and so was sitting at her feet being nourished upon what he was saying. So in the true sense, she had chosen the better part. And, you know, we can't draw a clear parallel, certainly, between the gospel story of Martha and Mary and these two men. But I think it speaks to something of the truth being communicated here, that on a deeper level, this one monk, albeit a little lazy, saw a greater truth. And he let go of attachments to the world in a greater way, and a way that perhaps wouldn't be seen by others. That it is most often difficult for us to let go of what gives us a sense of security, of safety, of stability, a clarity of a sense of where we are going and what we are doing. And when we go through some of the additional stories here, this is what's going to become very clear for us, that part of following Christ is allowing him to lead us and to guide us where he desires us to go, to place ourselves in his hands. And so often, even in our religiosity, and perhaps sometimes especially in our religiosity, we cling to our own will and our own judgment. And there can be a kind of profound delusion that arises in that, because we can be all the more convinced of our perceiving the truth when it comes to religious matters, especially when we are armed with certain sayings of the fathers, or even certain things within the scriptures, or armed by our own sensibilities of, you know, hard work is being the source of a man or a woman's worth. And look, you know, I think when we look at our own world, you know, we often judge ourselves and others by exactly that same criterion, that, you know, a hard work makes the person, you know, good grades, getting the good job, raises, upward mobility. And we can't cling to that when it comes to living out the gospel. This idea of upward mobility, even in terms of the spiritual life, that if we're just striving up this mountain of virtue, and if we're just industrious enough and we're striving hard enough, that we are going to climb up that mountain of virtue, whereas we are rather to entrust ourselves to the will of God, in the same way that Christ entrusted himself to the Father and embraced his will completely, and even when it meant for him sweating blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. And so we have to be very careful, I think, when we read the fathers, and sometimes when we hear stories about the extraordinary things that they have done, and when we hear this about others too, and when we read the ascetical literature, not to get caught up in this notion that it is simply in ascetical acts or in discipline that our salvation is to be found. Certainly, Christianity is an ascetical religion, as we've talked about before, the exercising of our faith. We seek to discipline and order our lives to overcome the passions, to grow in virtue. And so the human response, the human element, is certainly a great part of this, but the greatest part is grace. And we embrace this asceticism not to simply strengthen our will, but to be able to embrace the will of God as fully as we can, and to take hold of the grace that he's given us in order to do his will. And so in some ways, you know, this, again, this one monk, though not excelling in the discipline, excelled in the sense of abandonment to God and abandonment to his will and his grace, to relying upon him alone, of allowing God to be his one security. Daniel Allen.
I heard very recently from a podcast from Glory to God blog that the phrase "God helps those who help themselves" that's not from the Bible or the saints. I think I would have probably said that if I were asked. That is from the first self-help book ever made out of the Scottish Reformation. And what you just said here, like, really kind of, like, you know, with the lazy monk and things like that, it just dawned on me in the middle of it. It jogged my memory of that. But not to try to make a virtue out of laziness, but I mean, it is a very interesting, it's a very countercultural thought, at least for me.
No doubt. And, you know, I think we can see how it can even manifest itself within the life of the church as a whole. You know, we can go through periods where the church can seem to be, and parishes and religious communities can be run like a business. It can be about efficiency or productivity. If you work in campus ministry, you know, often how you are judged is by how many students you have coming to your groups. How many students are you connecting with in one way or another? Not the depth of that connection or the fruit that is often, can often be intangible, but numbers. But, you know, this is not part of the Christian teaching or of the gospel. You know, it's the depth of that response to Christ is what we are called to foster. There can be a superficial way in which we live that religiosity. And many times, again, we've talked about that Freudian concept of auxiliary construction, you know, religion as a mental construct, and how powerful that can be, that we can embrace a religious identity and religious practices in such a way that it is really more about shaping the ego, the sense of self, self-identity. And it can give us a sense of security in this world that often is very harsh, demanding, where there's great suffering. And yet there isn't necessarily within that a deep relationship with God, that it can be very much something that is of the mind that we wouldn't part with under any circumstances, because it has become so much a part of our identity. But it might be nothing more to us than that old comfortable pair of shoes that we love and we would never part with, or that old chair, that is part of our life and part of our identity and what gives a kind of stability to us. But is it really reflective of this relationship where we are called into the perfection, the love, the perfection and the love, the depth of the love of God himself, a divine love, the self-emptying love, a cruciform love that involves the dying to self and sin? And so in some measure, the remoteness, the exile that the foreigner had embraced involved a greater dying to self, you know, that he had to set aside part of his identity by removing himself from the place of his origin. And for us, that might not seem to be like such a great thing. And I think we want to certainly let some of the other stories, we have Abba Isaiah and St. Diaticus coming up, let them flesh it out for us a little bit more. But you're right. I mean, I think, you know, we live in a culture, you know, of self-help ideology, you know, where, you know, the self-made man, the self-made woman, this is what we admire. And this is, you know, we hold this out as the great promise you know, of our, the freedom of, you know, of our country and, you know, the pursuit of happiness for ourselves. But, you know, all that can be focused, again, more on the self than it is upon God. In fact, we see the opposite in the gospel, downward mobility, not upward mobility. Okay. So why don't we go on to Abba Isaiah here, and he gives us, you know, far more detail in terms of what the fathers were speaking of here. Again, taking us far afield from simply remoteness of location. If you decide to live as a stranger for the sake of God, do not attempt to make acquaintances with the inhabitants of the place where you go, and do not have many relations with them, for in that case, it is better to stay with your blood relatives. If you take a cell in your native place, do not allow yourself to make too many friends. One person is enough, so that you will have a helper if you become ill. Take care not to lose the benefits that living in a remote place brings you. If you go to live in some place, do not wait until you know how people live there in order to get a cell, but to do so immediately so that you avoid any reservations, whether about uneasiness, rest, or some obstacle placed before you by friends. For if you are wise, you will consider all of these things to be but a few days' duration, your death and your life as well. So, you know, certainly, again, when we are thinking of this in terms of monks, you know, of moving to a place where they aren't scoping things out ahead of time, where, you know, that looks like they're going to have great support there in the life that they're going to lead, that what they are seeking to be responsive to is the call to God, come follow me. And for the monk in this particular way, go sell all that you possess, give it to the poor, come follow me. And so not looking for security while letting go of that security and attachment. That doesn't make sense. He says, you might as well stay home and live with your family. If this is the concern that you're starting out with, that your one desire is to seek that remoteness, not for as an end in itself, but in order that, again, that you might be attached fully to Christ, that you might cling to him and to his grace and trust in that in the fact that he's going to provide for you. And not, you know, not many of us in our generation would take this path. You know, I think, again, we want to scope things out to make sure, you know, it's the best possible decision, that our talents fit this particular place or group or job, you know, and even in terms of how people discern anymore. It's not so much listening to God and God's will, but it's, you know, where can my talents and abilities be used? Or what is it, what is the particular ministry of this group? Or even, you know, certain aspects of religious practice and how they engage in it, or the habit that they wear, the style of the habit. It can even become as simplistic as this. And so even in pursuing a vocation, our focus can very easily in the discernment be pulled off of Christ. And it can be about what is going on, how we feel internally. And what he's already saying here in the first paragraph, for even for those who are monks, that they can be so easily swayed by the voice of a friend or a relative telling them that they really need to be concerned about these things, how to protect themselves to make sure that they're going to be happy, that they won't be put in jeopardy. And he's right. You know, it doesn't take very much to enliven within us a kind of fear and anxiety about setting out into the unknown. And I think when we look simply at our own lives and our relationship with Christ and our own response to that call, come follow me, you know, in that, we, I think, have to look honestly in examination of our own hearts, you know, how much are we clinging to our own will in that response? How much are we responding simply to the point where we are comfortable. Like this weekend's gospel of the elderly woman throwing in her last two coppers into the alms boxes. You know, she gives in her whole, she throws in her whole livelihood. Christ says most others give out of their surplus, you know, where they might not even know it, and it doesn't hurt at all because they have such abundance. Whereas this woman, this elderly woman, throws in, you know, what the last that she has. And it's then that he jumps to his feet and he's able to tell the apostles, this is what I've been talking about. Because the Pharisees had begun to sneer at him because he had been saying, you cannot serve God and mammon. You cannot serve God and money. You end up hating one and loving the other, or despising one and loving the other. And so he says, this is what the kingdom is about. And it, you know, in reflecting upon that, not to reiterate my homily, but he's not speaking simply about our response to God, you know, giving our all, or our response to others, you know, giving in abundance to others. But he's speaking first of God's gift of himself to us. That what we see and are meant to see first and foremost is God throwing everything, as it were, into the alms box. And not just what is precious to him, but is essential to him and what he needs the most. And God so loved the world that he gave us his only begotten son. This is the standard. This is the model of love for us. And so when we look at these stories, we want to have the backdrop of the gospel in mind, because this is what they were reflecting upon. This was their spiritual reading, and this is what they become living icons of the gospel itself. And so again, you know, seeing them make this choice, you know, part of us is to capture something of what Jesus saw in that old woman, that this is what God is asking from us, this kind of unconditional offer of oneself and entrusting of oneself to God and his will, in the same way that, again, that Christ offers himself completely to the Father. And this is a jarring thing to our sensibilities. And so, again, it's easy for us to take these stories of these desert monks and say, these are monks. You know, this doesn't apply to us. Well, it applies directly to us, because what they're bearing witness to is at the very heart of the gospel and the heart of our response to God. That in our day-to-day life, whatever our station might be, every single day of our life is, you know, are those moments where we are called to say no to our own will and yes to God. And where we are called to step out of that which is familiar and secure to us and go where he desires us to go. You know, speaking from experience, you know, as a priest, you can get pretty comfortable when you fill up your calendar, when the calendar gets so full that it blocks out room for everything else. Because even though you're busting your behind, you're working your hard and you're exhausted, there is this sense that you are giving everything. But it's such a controlled and calculated giving. You know, you can determine who it is that you're seeing, what is it you're doing. You can structure your day. You know, there was a period, I've mentioned this to some people in the group before, that I used the Franklin planner, the Franklin Covey kind of model, where you prioritize things. And I was super productive. I was accomplishing more than I had ever accomplished before. You know, and you check off things and you get that little satisfaction. I checked off an A thing. It's a priority. And you make your way down and you see this whole list that you've checked off for the day. And there can be a kind of satisfaction with that. And you could be exhausted, but you go to bed thinking, I left it all out there, you know. But there can be a subtle illusion caught up in that, you know, this sense of you know, work again, working hard, not being lazy, as being equated with doing the will of God and responding to his will in our lives. You know, when we crowd out everything so tightly, then we can miss so many opportunities where someone comes into the building and wants to speak with a priest, or you get a call from someplace where they can't find a priest to come and anoint somebody who's dying, and the hospital happens to be, you know, across town, and it would mean canceling all these other appointments and things such as that. That, you know, Lyle, before the group, said, you know, you came to learn long ago the thing as a Christian, things don't happen by chance. It's not luck, it's providence. And the hand of God is in all these different things. And, you know, I had this one experience very early on as a priest. A cousin, and who's a good bit older, he's the eldest cousin in the family and closer to my mom's age than to my age. And because he's the son of the eldest sister, she's the youngest of her siblings. And I was the ring bearer at his wedding, and his wife got cancer, and it was a brain tumor. And I got a call from his daughter, who I hadn't really much of a relationship at all, because I hadn't seen her in years, but it was a call saying that, and they're Eastern Orthodox too. And she said, you know, certainly the priest had been there, you know, ahead of time, but her father was there with his mother, and that it wasn't going to be long. And you know, I had, you know, that sort of internal battle in the mind, what to do, how to respond. You know, should I go in the morning, go tomorrow? And I went right then. And I got to the hospital, and, you know, was there, my cousin, older cousin, was there, and said a number of prayers. And then about 15, 20 minutes after I was there, she passed away. And it was a kind of, it was an important moment. It was a privileged moment. You know, the ring bearer at their wedding also being there at the moment when she passed. And it was, you know, to be there also for him. Again, it was a kind of special privilege for me, not even as a priest, but simply as a cousin, you know, and to be with him in this most painful of moments. And it's one of those things, you know, if one is guided only by one's will or what one's plan or one's schedule or what is convenient, then I think we are going to miss these opportunities where God is calling us to respond, to drop everything. Like Peter and Andrew, James and John, drop their nets and follow him. And this is in part what is being spoken of here. You know, that there is this attunement, attentiveness to the will of God that takes precedence over everything. Everything is subordinated to it. And we are willing to drop everything in order to satisfy and respond to what God wills, even if it's contrary to our personal inclinations or something that's inconvenient. And so, again, you know, I think it's so easy for us to dismiss these as sort of archaic stories or limited to the fathers, but I think we see how closely, again, they are tied to the gospel and of letting go of the control of things in order to be most responsive to the will of God. And, you know, I've told that story before about the Trappist monks when, you know, the one monk who was painting the ceiling and came down to the last little square in the ceiling, and the bell for prayer rang. And so he drops his, you know, paintbrush and goes to prayer. And all the monks filing through this room look up in the ceiling and they see this one blank spot and they all laugh at him, you know, because, you know, the job was left done. This is the one little spot in the ceiling. But there was a fundamental obedience. He was called by something greater there than efficiency or productivity, and to allow himself to be guided by that call of God. I know that was a bit rambly here, but does anybody have any comments or questions? Okay, so we'll move on with Abba Isaiah. Above all struggles and first in rank is removing oneself to a remote place. If one does so alone and as an unknown person, leaving everything behind and coming into a faraway place, taking with him as provisions his perfect faith in God, his hope, and a heart steadfast in its intentions. For surely, if you do this, the demons will encircle you in great numbers. They will intimidate you with thoughts about trials, severe poverty, and fearful illnesses. They will implant in your mind uneasy thoughts so that you will fall into their hands. What will you do? Is there anyone to care for you? Who will befriend you? And God will test you so that your zeal and love for him might be made manifest. So in a sense, God allows this testing to take place. The demons will immediately, and we can be assured of it, that they will immediately jump on the offensive. They will attack the moment somebody is contemplating giving themselves over to God fully, that they will plant, they will add to one's thoughts all of these additional concerns, illness, who will take care of you? What if this happens to you? You know, it's funny, I joined the oratory because we moved around about a dozen times when I was growing up, and I thought, I'm sticking in one place. And the oratorians promised stability, and I've been here for 35 years. But living in the same place does not necessarily provide stability. And, you know, you learn that pretty quickly. You know, living in one place does a lot, you know, in a different way. Philip Neri had a vision there, but, you know, community life is the greatest of joys, but it's also the greatest of mortification. It's constantly rubbing off the edges, you know, by staying in one place and allowing those around you to do that work for you as well as you to do it for them. But it's not that it doesn't create a worldly stability. What our goal is in staying in one place is to keep this kind of focus upon God that is being spoken of here in order that our stability and our peace might be that of the kingdom. There can be as much chaos in a community where you stay in one place as there is anywhere else within the world. And that can be true in family life as well. And, you know, all the things that a person faces in whatever state, and if they're going to be fully committed to that in marriage and being a husband, wife, father, mother, or living as a religious or a priest, you know, the demons are all going to come at us and focus in on that fundamental identity and seek to pull us away from it one way or another, from the hardships that often go along with it and the particular crosses that are often associated with it, and want us to move away from it. And often people do, you know, thinking that changing externals are going to free them from these particular trials and the battles that the demons bring to us. But changing externals won't do it. You know, it's clinging to the one that Isaiah says is an everlasting rock, an eternal rock. That's our stability. And the remoteness that is being spoken of here, no matter how we understand it, whether it's in places with the monks or in our day-to-day life, it's by resting upon the eternal rock and upon him alone, not resting upon the things of the world, that we find the peace and stability of the kingdom. And that no one can take from us. Any thoughts or comments, or should I go on to the next? All right. Now, if you close yourself up alone in your cell, the demons will also sow in your mind other heavy thoughts of cowardice and will continually whisper these to you. Withdrawal to a remote place. Withdrawal to a remote place does not alone save a man, but also the maintenance of the commandments. They will bring to the mind the memory of all whom you encounter in the world together with your blood relatives and will say to you, are not all of these servants of God? After that, they will make you think about the anomalies of the seasons and the burden of the body and implant in your heart other similar thoughts so that it will be taken by inattention. So again, you know, the whispering of all of these thoughts. So even after one has moved to the remote place, has made that fundamental step and that commitment, the nature of the whisperings of the demons just shifts. It becomes no less direct, you know, and putting before us the things that would call into question the decision already made. What about your relatives? Aren't they children of God? Living in a cell isn't the most important thing. It's keeping the commandments. So why wouldn't you focus on them rather than pulling yourself away from the world? And, you know, aren't you more short of living out the commandments by living in the world than you are by living remotely in this cell? And so the whisperings that would come to us living in the world, you know, can be just as seductive, you know. Isn't it better to be out in the world and engaging all these different people? We can bring the gospel to people's lives. And so we just need to insert ourselves, immerse ourselves in the culture around us in order that we can engage people to be like leaven, you know, that we, you know, immerse ourselves in the world around us. You know, it's a very seductive notion, you know. Let us build a city of God again, you know, let us build a city of God, you know, put our, you know, ourselves to work here to construct something. And again, it's a very powerful notion because it's telling us that what is of greater importance are all these things that we're doing or what we can shape rather than what's going on within the depths of one's heart, humility, love, detachment. All the things that really allow the grace of God to act most fully within the human heart. So, you know, it can be those living in these cells or those living, you know, in a cloistered convent that we have here in Pittsburgh that might be the sole thing there that is holding our diocese together, which is sort of hanging by a string, I'm sad to say. But, you know, it is often those who are living this hidden life and are rooted in the passion and have given themselves over fully that can elevate the church and strengthen those who are engaged in an act of ministry or strengthen, you know, couples and their commitment and the fidelity in their marriages. Anthony.
Yes, part of the issue, I think, can also be cultural. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I'm Italian, very close family. I've got a duty, so to speak, to be with my family, especially in a culture that is very much against our values, all right? And you can make yourself crazy by thinking, oh, shouldn't I be a priest? Or shouldn't I be doing this, going off to a monastery or whatever? Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you can look and say, okay, these desert fathers say, hey, sometimes people are more better saved in the world than going out into the desert. Mm-hmm. Or I have these particular gifts, trying to take stock of them. How can I use them best? Mm-hmm. Or, oh, if I have repugnance for this type of religious life, is that a problem with me? Or is it just that it's not fitting? how do you not make yourself crazy and try to do what's right, you know?
Right. Well, it's a good question. And I think often people do find themselves spinning around in circles when it comes to these kinds of questions. And often because the discernment begins with the self. And whenever that happens, I'm going to have to mute everybody here. I'm getting some feedback. Whenever that happens, you know, that it does become our judgment, our imagination, all of the thoughts that we have about religious life, how we compare things, weigh them against each other. These become the things that we're trying to balance. And often what begins to take place is what has a stronger emotional pull on us on a given day. So one day we think we should be a priest. One day we think we should be married. I run into this all the time where people are trying to discern two things at one time. And the proverbial, you know, pre-seminarian who's also dating a girl at the same time. And, you know, one day he wants to get married and have 8 children. And the next day he's telling her, you know, I think I have a vocation to the priesthood. And then bada boom, you know, a broken heart. And inevitably it happens, no matter how many times I say it. And you can't discern two things at the same time. But even beyond that, I think it's not our discernment so much as it is our listening to God and allowing him to say, it's Christ who says, come follow me. And we want to be sure that it's a response to that call rather than, you know, our own inclinations, our, you know, own religious imagination that is leading and directing us. And those things can be very powerful. And there has to be both a kind of spiritual and emotional maturity there that allows a person to listen on a very deep level, that you're not even simply being drawn by your own personal inclinations. You know, even in terms of priesthood and religious life, one might be more personally inclined by temperament to a life of greater solitude. But it might be the will of God that he be involved in an active life, you know, of priesthood and living a life of deep prayer, but seeking, you know, responding in the way that God has called him to. So that personal inclination or that temperament alone is not necessarily the reason why one would pursue a certain path. And, you know, it must have been striking, and it was striking for so many of those that Christ called, you know, these fishermen, come follow me. Matthew, the tax collector, that painting of him being pointed to, his head sort of down, you know, looking at his money, and, you know, of all people would have thought himself the least likely to be called. Or little Zacchaeus, you know, the same thing, you know, today I will eat at your house, you know, and everybody's sort of scoffing at the idea, you know, and it, along with Zacchaeus himself, you know, and so, you know, we should take that as a kind of lead for us, you know, that it's Christ who calls. It's not necessarily, you know, there was anyone he could have called, Greek philosopher, you know, someone who could articulate the faith with beauty and eloquence, a Roman soldier who would have had a certain authority, you know, and dignity, you know, any number of people. Instead, you know, he called fishermen, you know, tax collectors, a zealot, these individuals then that he could also send out with nothing, you know, no extra tunic, you know, no walking stick, all the, you know, he sends them out with nothing except to rely upon the gift of the Spirit. And again, we typically look at that as past history rather than something that is a word that is spoken to us in the moment. You know, when Christ calls us and says, come follow me, how responsive are we in whatever the circumstances those might be, to drop everything and follow him? And part of our problem is that we live out also in the future. rather than in the one place that we know Christ is, and that's in the moment. And that's where discernment is to take place as well, in our responsiveness to live the call of holiness right here and now. Salvation is now, in this moment. It's not trying to undo the past. It's not daydreaming about the future. It's our responsiveness to living out the gospel fully in the moment. And, as St. Theophan told Anastasia in our Wednesday group, God will make his will known. Things will coalesce in such a way that the path ahead will present itself. What she must be is faithful to this call to holiness and of setting aside the passions and fostering the virtues of praying without ceasing. That is what's going to allow us to hear God. So, I think in general, our focus either in living out the Christian life or our discerning a vocation is typically misdirected. And most often because the direction is toward the self. Our discernment begins and ends with me, rather than with God. Now, I don't know how I got in the oratory. If I look back and if someone like me came knocking at the door, I would say, I think you need a couple more years, buddy, I don't think I would let me in the front door. Sue and Mark.
Hey, okay, well, actually I was just about to lower my hand, but I think it's really interesting. What you were saying today about where, just a little bit ago, where you were really talking about how we really want to follow and be out there and everything else. I have a hard time with this. The desert stuff is really hard for me. And so just this morning, I'm sitting here after my prayers and going, oh, God, this is not for me. I don't think I can be here. I have to go out. I need to do this. I need to be with people. I need to be doing this and that and the other thing. And I'm even saying, I have some gifts and talents that I should be using, and all those different things. And yet I know that God brought me into this. I have a hard time with it. I struggle with it. I'm on top of it. It's on top of me. We're rolling around. I'm complaining bitterly about orthodoxy and how much I don't really like it too much. And it's a hard place for me to be. And yet I know he wants me here. And there's a book that I have here that he sent to me, and it's by Nancy Schumann. So you're familiar with her. It's The Cloistered Heart. And she really talks about the grill. And there are some lines in here that are really wonderful, and you can replace the grill with the desert, because it's the same thing, whether you're in a cloister or whether you're in your house, and the theology and the giving over the will to God, that is really what she's saying here. And some of these lines, she just says, I love God by choice, by decision. I love God's will, my beloved bridegroom, but I'm not too sure I like it. And that's just so human and so real, because what she's saying is, my will is enclosed in God's will, but I'm not really sure that I like God's will, but I'm gonna give myself over to that. And I really think that is what this is all about. As you say, just, it's like giving your will over, and learning how to give your will over is really, really hard work.
Right. And I remember coming across her website. She since passed away.
Yes.
But she wasn't a religious. She wasn't a Carmelite.
No,
but there was something about the spirituality that spoke to her heart, and the sense of giving her heart over fully. This idea of a cloistered heart. A heart that belongs to the beloved alone,
right.
And that spoke to her. And so I think you're right. I mean, I think part of what we find in the Desert Fathers is not this, and they even tell us, not everybody's called, in fact, very few are called to live in the desert. But the desert for all of us exists 2 inches beneath the chest. It's the human heart. And so what the struggle that they're talking about is lies within. And, you know, part of us wants to put it out there. You know, it's like, okay, they're talking only about those who lived, you know, in the early church and who removed themselves. But in reality, they're talking about the gospel and the spiritual warfare that we engage in, the principalities and powers that we struggle with, our own passions. You know, this is what is at the heart of the matter here.
Right.
And it's true, you know, with this idea of exile. And I think the more and more we become comfortable in the world, we have to question ourselves. You know, how deeply are we immersed in our relationship with Christ when we know that we are not long for this world, that there's such brevity? And, you know, if our focus is and our energy is directed so much to the things of this world, how are we responding to the gospel? Or has it become something that is a comfortable part of our identity? Again, giving this kind of false security, fire insurance.
Right. And also in the present moment, it is the being. It is just being and being present. Doing the will of God is about being and in the present moment and doing the will in the present moment. It's right. Just great. It's just pretty good.
Okay. Very good. Anthony, did you have a follow-up or is your hand just still up? Okay.
Sorry about that. It was a mistake.
Okay. Okay. Where did I leave off here? Let's see. The bottom of the page. Is that correct? Very bottom of the page? Okay. If, however, love and hope dwell in your heart, these ill whispers will have no effect. For then the desire that you have for God will show forth if you indeed love him more than your physical comfort. You did not withdraw to a remote place without reason, but in order to prepare yourself for the fight against your enemies and to know how to crush each one of them in the appropriate circumstance until you are made free and reach the rest of passionlessness. And so, you know, part of this exile is removing ourselves to a point where we're able to identify and engage the enemy in a spiritual battle, that we retreat, as it were, to Christ, you know, not to a particular place within the world, but we retreat from the world and all the things that give rise to the passions in order that we might identify the enemies and engage them even more fully, until we come to know something of that rest, that peace in Christ. And I've told this story here before about St. Charbel, but some of you might not have heard it. When, you know, he had lived in the community a long time and had been very obedient, and the hermit of the community had died. He was a Maronite monk and priest, and the abbot chooses him to be the hermit of the community. And one of the interesting things that the abbot says to the community is that, you know, this is not a prize, you know, that he's going into, in a sense, a deeper battle and entering into the hermitage. So he's not given this prize of being able to go live, you know. I know I post a lot of things about cabins in the woods, and that's more about me wanting to get away from everything. But what the abbot is saying is the clear truth, that one enters into the hermitage not to escape the world or escape reality, but because one has already, in a sense, gained a certain purity of heart that allows one to see the reality more clearly. And so he enters into the hermitage in order to fight the good fight of faith on an even deeper level. It's there that he goes to engage in the warfare against the demons on a much more profound level, in the depth of his prayer and the depth of that solitude. And again, very few are called to this. But, you know, again, I think the point that should step out for us here is that we are to create a kind of simplicity within our lives that allows us to draw back into silence and solitude, where we can engage God, but we also can still the heart. We can see our own passions with a kind of clarity, and we can begin to engage in that spiritual warfare with the demons. And so this kind of retreat to remoteness, you know, we create this solitude for ourselves that allows for this deeper prayer, and we emulate the Desert Fathers in the spiritual battle. So long as we are immersed in the world and we are immersed in all the things of the world, its entertainments, its distractions, we are not going to be engaged in this kind of spiritual battle. And so we have to allow Christ to draw us out into a deserted place to be alone in order to engage in prayer, but also to engage in this spiritual battle. And so, you know, there's a part of us that is going to balk at this kind of exile, you know, because there's a part of us that is always going to want the comforts that the world offers, even those that are most benign. And yet sometimes because they are most benign also prevent us in the strongest way from engaging in that spiritual battle. There's a part in the gospel where, you know, Christ is calling various individuals, and it says three times they each excuse themselves. And the word excuse comes from ex causa, free from the charge. And so Jesus is saying, you know, they're freeing themselves from the charge of this greater call. And they're all reasonable things. You know, a wife, I just bought a farm, blah, 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 you know, but in reality, they become plausible lies to free us from the charge of following Christ and embracing the path of the gospel. And so, you know, again, we have to, I think, look at our lives and say, you know, is there a simplicity that must begin to emerge and that I work towards over the course of time? What are the things that I set aside in order that I might move to that quiet place in order to listen to Christ, but also to engage in this spiritual battle against the passions? Ren Witter.
Hey, it's funny. Initially, I had a question, and then the question answered itself really quickly. But I had initially been thinking, you know, this sort of all in that we've been speaking about, and that was so striking in the gospel from this past weekend for the Roman Rite Catholics. We had different readings, obviously, but, you know, there's something about the widow's whole livelihood, which, you know, it's interesting. If the rich people had given everything and she gave everything, they both gave the same, which was everything, no matter what that looks like, which is hopeful for people, because we're not all the same and we don't all have like the same objective amount of whatever it is to give, but the ask is everything, not like a quantity. But my thought was like, so how do you start giving everything? Like a little, like how do you take like a baby step in giving everything? And as that question came to mind, like, if you feel really convicted tonight, what do you do tomorrow? Because, you know, you're still going to be taking little steps. And then what we were just talking about with the come and follow me and dropping everything came to mind. And it's like, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like little timid baby steps for a long time is really the the plan is sort of like, if you're called, that's it. You're called and you drop everything and you go. And it's what the apostles did, and it's what the saints did, and the martyrs. And like, we don't have a whole lot of saints who like took little, who like tested out the water.
Baby steps.
Yeah, it's very intimidating.
It's a good point. And, you know, I think we can't wait until we are prepared. If we do, we're never going to do anything. And so to respond is to already to express a kind of trust in God and what he provides. That in essence, we know that we are wholly unprepared for this kind of living the gospel within the world and responding. I think maybe the first way that we do respond is by prayer, you know, because in essence, it's an act of faith. It's saying that God is the center of our life. The beginning and end of all things. And, you know, you talked about, you know, the kind of inspiration tonight, or what was the word that you used? It's
conviction.
Conviction tonight. Well, and what do we do tomorrow? Well, I think already by saying what do we do tomorrow is sort of the wrong question. It's what do we do with that conviction right now? Because often we can be inspired tonight reading the Evercatinos, and yet crawl off to bed really quickly because we're tired, rather than responding to the conviction to pray. And once we shelve that inspiration, you know, it often cools and we won't find it there in the morning or tomorrow, how we do that. Well, tomorrow I'm going to take this up. You know, I think when we have this, when we see the truth or we hear the truth, we are to embrace it. And I think that this image of the dropping of the nets immediately and following him is always this strikingly powerful image. You know, how is it we respond to the word of God in our life? You know, do we drop what is false, what is less, for what is greater and what is perfect and true? And often we will hesitate and we'll, you know, weigh them in the balance, and, you know, and again, that moment passes. You know, how many of us have probably felt that call to prayer, and for one reason or another, you know, for all the little whisperings of the evil ones, we've probably heard the same thing. You're pretty tired. You worked hard yesterday. Hit that snooze button. You know, you got the sniffles. You might be getting a cold. Stay in bed. You know, we all play, you know, it's not even our playing these mind games. I think it's sometimes, as they describe here, the whisperings of the devil, of the demons, in order to prevent us from responding to that call of Christ. And I think, you know, when we look at the gospel and we look at these stories, part of it is calling us respond now. Christ is in the moment. You know, love him now, do his will now. And again, you know, getting back to Lyle's point, even before the group began, of letting go of this thing of, you know, coincidence or chance, you know, and looking for God in that moment, the providence of God, the presence of God in these moments, holding out these opportunities for us to love, to respond to him, to do his will. I always get freaked out a little bit. My vocation rests upon a chance encounter with somebody I met on the street 35 years ago. And I often think to myself, and I get a little unsettled by it, because I think, you know, if that did not take place, you know, this, let me just fill in the gaps a little bit. I was walking down the street. I was a freshman in college with a buddy who lived across the hall, and we were going to try to get into a pub as stupid freshmen would think they could. And when, but I, we were walking down the main thoroughfare here in Oakland, and I looked over and I saw a woman that I thought, gee, that looks my, like my sister's best friend from high school. And I said, nah, it can't be. What would she be doing here in the middle of the universities? And she, you know, a good 6 years older. And so I kept walking on, and looked like she was waiting at the bus stop. And so we went, and we couldn't get into the bar. And so we went, of all places, to a video arcade on the street down. And I look over again, and I see this same woman. And this time she came over to me and she said, are you David Abernethy? And I said, yes. And we got to talking a little bit, and her, turns out her brother went to the university here, and she invited me to the Catholic student house at Carnegie Mellon for a Christmas party. And that's where I met all the students who came to the Newman Center. And if it wasn't for that one moment, I don't know if I'd be Catholic. I'm sure God would have worked in other ways, but it came down to that one moment that led to this invitation, that led to a meeting to, of all these Catholics, then to being exposed to the Mass, that started this path in motion. And, you know, in some sense, it should be unsettling, you know, enough to at least speak to us to say, we can't take certain things for granted, you know, that there has to be this sense where we are looking for God and we are listening for his voice, because it can be precisely in these things and these encounters often that are least expected where we hear him and see him the most. Good thing I didn't get into that bar that night. What would I've done? So, any final comments or questions? I know, again, it's a lot. You know, when you read, I think the Evercatinos, I love the Philokalia, but there's something about the Evercatinos where it's not simple statements, sayings of the fathers, but it is these stories that really then make the truth that is put forward in the hypothesis come to life. And it doesn't make it easy. I mean, you really have to suspend judgment. You have to have, with a kind of spirit of generosity, listen to be what is, not to set aside critical thinking, but to listen to what is being said and allow your sensibilities to be challenged, your worldview to be challenged in order to be able to hear what they are saying. And I think we see this in the gospel as well. You know, there were those who were really closed off to just about everything that Christ said, you know, because he was this humble carpenter. But love incarnate, truth incarnate, right before their eyes, and they could not see him. Okay. So hang in there, guys. We only have probably about 1,100 more pages to go, but we're making some solid headway. We're a quarter of the way through the first volume. So we'll get there. All right. So when we close, as always, with the Our Father, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
Be to God.